Have you brought up John Banville before? You've heard of him, right?
I have heard of him.
Okay. Seems like your type of author.
I could go on a little tangent if you want.
Hey, perfect.
I heard about John Banville about 15 years ago. He wrote a book called The Sea. That's what I'm getting at. And it got all this praise and won all these awards. And a short little novel. And I was like, okay, this is a new author. I want to check him out. Started reading him. His vocabulary, you pretty much have to look up about 5 to 10 words every page.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyable story. I've been meaning to get back to him. But yeah, that's my John Banville story.
Okay. So, just The Sea.
Mm-hmm. I do own some of his other books, though.
Oh.
In the appearance that I'm a huge John Banville fan, so if you break into my home, steal my books, you're like, oh man, this guy's a big Banville guy.
Which ones do you have?
I don't even know.
Okay.
I haven't seen. And when I have a theory that you can find him at used bookstores quite often because of his style. Not everyone's cup of tea.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, do you remember how it was your birthday a couple of weeks ago?
I do.
You do anything? You told me after the fact.
Well, you know, it's modest. It's modest.
No big deal. Dudes in their 30s do birthdays differently anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big deal. Do you know when my birthday is?
I guessed a completely wrong month, and you told me end of May.
Yeah, end of May is the real one. I'm a Gemini.
Don't give me a date.
No, I'm not going to.
I'll know by the look of the moon.
It'll be June, and you'll be like, oh, crap. Because I knew yours was March,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned you went and did something. I was like, oh, I guess we're not doing anything. But that's fine. So I got you this.
Ooh.
Snow by John Banville.
Yeah, thank you.
I was like, Banville, that's Peter's guy. But then I was like, wait, am I confusing him with John Barry or another guy with a similar name? So I posted on Twitter earlier today, hey, does anybody know anything about this? I got some responses. Somebody was like, this is like Snow is a... Banville writes mysteries sometimes under a pen name.
Yeah, he does have a series that I didn't realize.
Yeah, it's a pen name. And then this, I guess, is a mystery under his own name. And the person I was talking to on Twitter, I was like, why do I think he's a literary guy? And she kind of told me that was because he usually, he is kind of a literary.
Did
he writes confusing
flip
stuff.
It and see some new words there?
No, it doesn't look too bad, but this might be because it looks like a mystery. It's got a cabin with snow.
No, I see that.
Like, oh.
I'm describing it had the picture of the sea. It's called The Sea.
Maybe he likes places and weather. But the house in this one, it looks like, okay, somebody is murdered there and somebody's got to figure out what's going on.
John Banville's an author. Like, I decided, whenever, 2010, that I should read him and like him. And I'm kind of pot committed at this point.
Hey, so perfect. Unless you already have it.
I don't have that.
Okay.
I'm pulling up a list of his works to see what I have. It's quite a long list. I can't read all these. That's crazy.
It's
books.
Well, yeah. Do you remember 2 years ago I got you The Secret History and you already had it? So well, it's good to know that didn't happen again.
Let's see, your Snow came out. He's been on a little bit of a kick, actually. So he had The Sea, which is the one I read in 2005. I think I have Ancient Light, and possibly Eclipse, and maybe one, and The Book of Evidence. I didn't realize that he had written in sort of like a trilogy, sort of like an informal trilogy. Anyway, Snow came out in 2020. And then he has what's called the Quirk series, and it's published as Benjamin Black, and that's an 8-book series.
Okay, yeah.
He writes quite fast.
That's a lot.
This is a pretty bookish intro. We're not usually known for these.
Banville, that's all I had. Banville and your birthday.
Banville and my birthday. Irish author.
Yeah, so that's cool. I'm glad I was worried I got him confused with some other people, or that you already had him or something, but
appreciate it.
It's interesting when I wonder if there's more than we know about of literary authors who write genre fiction under a pen name. Mm-hmm. Stephen King used to do it. He had the Stephen King stuff, and he wrote under Richard Bachman.
Yeah.
J.K. Rowling has a little mystery Private Eye series she does, but everybody knows it's not
that's
a secret.
Pretty well done. Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
I started a book. This is kind of sort of related. New library book. Let me bring up the title. I think it's The Proctor. Anyway. Got some of the reviews positive, so I picked it up. The Curator. Sorry. It's close. And written by Owen King. Didn't think any of it. Hadn't heard of him. And I'm about 40% of the way through, and I just realized it is Stephen King's son.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. That, I don't know how that ties to any of this intro, but...
Joe Hill is... I read...
I thought Joe Hill was the only son that wrote.
I read 20th Century Ghosts back in the day, not knowing it was Joe Hill was Stephen King's kid. And I remember thinking, like, this is pretty good, like Stephen King-ish. And then I looked up Joe Hill because I wanted to read... I read Horns, and it was like, oh, Stephen King's kid. That's...
Owen King kept the dad's name. But I was in its fantasy... sort of kind of fits in with our world, I guess.
Good.
It has parts that are really good. Other parts are a little, there's almost too much going on. It's almost like, I wish there would be a little bit focused on the good stuff and not the sort of, I don't know. It's a book where I finish 50 pages and I put it down, and then the next day I'm like, I don't really remember what happened. And I have the complete opposite with Life and Fate, which I've started to tackle, you know?
Yes.
So, I don't think it's my old brain is the issue. I think it might be the book. But, still plowing through it.
Okay. Well, I ask because I have a theory with kids of famous authors who are authors themselves.
Mm.
I don't think it's nepotism to the point it is in other professions. Like in business and politics... your dad can get you a job and you can coast in that job for a long time. You're right. But I think with books, I think nepotism might get you that first book contract. But to keep going, I don't think your parents being famous will keep you going because the book sells or it doesn't. You're either a good author or you're not. Like yeah, Joe Hill holds up.
I think it would be nepotism if it was like James Patterson's child, but... their child.
Yeah, and you got
no,
it.
But hold on. They use the ghostwriter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is, you're like, oh, is James Patterson's kid using the my ghostwriter? That would be probably, no, it's just not even right.
Yeah. So, but you see what I mean with like Martin Amis, maybe the Rachel Papers, his first book gets published because of his dad, but then the rest of his career is not going to hold up if you're a bad writer. Right. This Joe Hill may have gotten that first one through maybe his dad, yeah. But he didn't change. I don't know. But I think beyond that, you're kind of on your own. Your dad can't carry your whole career in the arts, in politics, in business. Yeah, nobody notices. You know?
Yeah. This Curator book has in the like acknowledgement section, it thanks a writer that is also in the blurb of the back. I always hate that.
I suspect the blurb world is a lot of grease and palms.
Full of lies? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe you just have some pattern. You haven't really read the book, but you just, you know.
Yeah, I'm surprised if everyone who wrote a blurb read the book.
I mean, there's just not enough time, but you're just doing your friend a solid, right? I mean,
if I wrote a book, would you just sight unseen do a blurb?
Yeah.
Would you read any of it?
Yeah, I'd read it. But if for some reason I didn't have time, I'd still do a nice blurb.
but just vague.
And there are certain people in my close circle, I shouldn't admit this, even if I didn't like it, I'd be like, eh, I love this. Not for everybody, but for like you and other people I've known a long time. Like, yeah, all right, whatever.
I would hope I wouldn't have to put you in that situation.
Nah, you wouldn't.
You would have to, where you'd have to compromise your integrity.
Watch the blurb. I'd use some blurb that dude's staggering work of heartbreaking genius.
You would just use other books in the blurb.
Yeah, it's piercingly human, vivacious. Murphy has an eye for detail that rivals the best of the Victorians. Just stuff like that. Just throw stuff out there.
Moby Dick, move over. Go to the bottom of the sea.
Whales are passe. Wolves.
Run the...
Yeah.
All right. I like that. And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and blurbs. I am Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt, a couple months ago, with our bursting TBR and our limited time and our busy schedules, we added some short stories to read. And I think we did it. I won't admit to this at the time, but maybe in hindsight, we kind of did it just to give ourselves a break. And if we didn't like the short stories, that's fine. We can get an episode out of it. And we added three short stories. I called them the spring short stories. The title to this Zoom call. And I have to say, as someone who has turned into not a big fan of short stories recently, like modern short stories, I'm sometimes left wondering, what was that about?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a magic trick that I just didn't get the sleight of hand? We chose three, I would go so far as to say, excellent short stories.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of surprised that that's how it turned out. Now, we did kind of pick classic short story authors, maybe two out of the three.
And we brought good ones to the table too.
Yeah. And so but I was surprised. I'll just say that. Were you surprised by, well, first of all, did you like the short stories we read?
Yeah.
Was that surprising?
Yeah, I liked them all. I mean, I'd read The Lottery and Woodhouse before. I was surprised. I enjoyed Chopin?
Chopin.
I agreed with it because it sounded literary. I told you earlier, I got her mixed up with Amy Tan. I thought she was more.
Yeah, how is that? They're not even remotely.
I had never read her before. I just the name when you mentioned it. And you're like, The Storm. And I was like, oh, sure. So.
Okay, yeah, that's, I like that.
And you brought up, you nominated The Lottery.
I had not read The Lottery.
But we like Shirley Jackson. I'd read it before, like a long time ago, so.
So we have Honeysuckle Cottage by P.G. Woodhouse, was one of our short stories. Next up, we have The Storm by Kate Chopin. I also read Regret for some reason. I have a collection of The Awakening and other short stories, and I read that. And I was like, oh, that's, I wrote all of my notations down. And then I just, let me double check, make sure that was a short story. And then I looked at my TBR thing. I was like, oh, it was a storm. Okay.
Do you want to start with her?
Yes. Let's do that.
I liked her. And The Storm, it says, I have The Awakening and other short stories. Mm-hmm. Penguin classics.
Oh, nice. That's a nice little addition there.
It's a new one. I had to go. It's the only one I could find, but it worked out. But The Storm's the last story. And right under the title, it says, a sequel to At the Cadian Ball. So I figured I'd read The Cadian Ball. So I read At the Cadian Ball too.
I don't think I have The Cadian Ball, if I'm being honest to you.
It doesn't say a sequel to The Cadian Ball.
No, it does. It Storm does.
Was published posthumously. It was too racy to be published. In
which
her,
is...
She wrote in, like, she was a late 1800s, early 1900s. Yeah,
she wrote this in 1898, and it wasn't published until 1969.
Yeah. I can kind of see why. It's not racy compared to today's standards, but it's...
Dare I say it's ahead of its time?
Like, I mean, I guess so.
It has some turns, and we'll get into the story, but it has turns in the story. It's like, what, it's 5-6 pages? It's not a long story. And it has a turn where it's like, huh, Okay, that's not what I would expect a story from 1898 to like do.
Yeah, it's racy for then. Maybe not so
So
much now, but yeah, it's.
basically, the plot of the short story, and if you haven't read these short stories, probably just stop right now and read these. None of these short stories are long. It'll take you half an hour to read all of them. Basically, the story starts with a father and a son being caught out in an approaching storm. It's kind of like a rainstorm. I didn't
Yeah,
think it was a cyclone because it the storm ends.
it's like a hurricane type. It feels like, I think it's Louisiana. That's
Yeah.
where she lived and wrote. So it feels like down by New Orleans in the swamp.
And the
There's a
father and
big
son
storm.
are worried. They're at this local store about the man's wife, the boy's mother, being alone at home as the storm approaches. And then the story shifts to the Calixta. I didn't know how to pronounce her name, the mom.
Calixta is how I said
Calixta.
it in my
And she's kind of doing some sewing, doing some laundry. And as the storm approaches, a gentleman shows up. Alessi, I can't say any of the names in this story. They're all French.
New Orleans, French,
French, yeah.
Frenchified New Orleans.
Arrives at the house, kind of a former acquaintance. You're not sure at first, what exactly the relationship is between these two. Turns out they were former, kind of had a passionate relationship.
Lovers, yeah.
He gets invited into the house in the classic Seinfeld sense, yada, yada, yada. They end up romantically coming together. And then the storm, the guy leaves, the storm ends, and the boy and the father come back to the house worried that the wife is going to be mad at them, but she kind of embraces them and sort of in a surprising way to them, I guess.
She's nicer than they're expecting her to be upset because they're dirty and got caught on the storm, but she's nice to
And then, this is kind of the last two parts. It's kind of written in, I guess, chapters. I guess these are almost like just paragraphs. The second chapter is kind of the longest one. But the fourth one, I believe it's the fourth one, you get to the viewpoint of the guy who had just come to the house. He's kind of the Alessi LaBruyère. He writes to his wife, who's also away, and he says, He told her not to hurry back, but if she and the babies liked it in Biloxi, to stay a month longer. He was getting on nicely, and though he missed them, he was willing to bear the separation a while longer. And that's kind of like, oh, this guy's a scumbag. Like, come on. You realize what he's doing here. He wants to continue this sort of affair with his former fling. And then the final part, and the part that I thought was like, this could almost be a book Oscars nomination for next year. Just like, then we get to the wife's point of the guy who just showed up, and she receives this letter and finds it very agreeable because she's kind of happy not being next to her husband. Like, she enjoys this maiden lifestyle that she refers to it. And the last line says, "So the storm passed and everyone was happy." And we can dive into it because that was a very basic outline of this story, right? There's a lot of nuance and sort of ambiguity to it, tons of symbolism, obviously, in this story, but I really appreciated just the unexpected shifts of like kind of adding characters. I wasn't expecting to, you know what I mean? I thought there would be like four characters,
The
right?
shift in perspective, yeah, at the
Yeah,
beginning.
or we would only be in the perspective of two of them, sort of the father and his son. And then the wife that kind of has the affair. So I appreciated all the sort of, in such a short time, you get fairly complex sort of weaving of a story and leaving you, the reader, to kind of unpack things and come up with your own theories, which I think this and the lottery do. Like, as a reader, you can be like, okay, let me get my literary theory hat on and come up with some ideas about what's going on. Because I have some notes about what I think is going on.
All right. What do you think? Because having read At the Cadian Ball, it kind of makes more sense, because it really is a sequel. Like, those same characters, you know, their backstory. But I'm curious about your theories before I go into the Cadian Ball.
My thing that I caught, and I read this twice, is there is a backstory here that's very intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
It is the beginning of chapter two, kind of the second part of the story. The wife, it goes from the husband and the son to the wife, and she felt no uneasiness for their safety. That's an intriguing line for me, because a storm is approaching, and she doesn't feel like unease for their safety. They're thinking about her in ways that she is not thinking about father and son. Yeah.
I was wondering, so did you take that as she doesn't care, or she assumes they're competent enough that she doesn't have to worry?
I didn't think they're competent enough that she doesn't have to. I think she was, I don't know. It's, I think her mind, because at one point else in the next part of the story, she gets like, when the guy, like a lightning bolt strikes a tree outside, and literally she falls back into this guy's arms, and then they kind of start the affair. And she talks about how she's like jolted out of a trance. She's almost like, I feel like that's part of it until the storm hits, is she's kind of in this sort of, I don't know, routine that she's kind of like turned off her brain to and her passion to.
Yeah.
And then I think it's interesting. The boy and the father come back to the house. They go through the storm, and the father's like really worried about dragging like mud and like having parts of the storm like come in and the wife being upset. And then he's very surprised when she like comes back and greets them in what I would think would be a normal, like, oh my gosh, I'm happy that you guys are safe. But that's mm-hmm. a surprise to the husband.
He's surprised she's being so nice to him.
Yeah, which hints to me that something has happened in the past. And I think that's just brilliant. That's like great storytelling, where there's something behind the actions that...
So, I know a little bit of the backstory.
Okay.
What I think, that part where he's surprised she's nice to him, I think you're supposed to read between the lines that, oh, maybe she's not, if not mean, just kind of a, you know, the type of lady who'll scold you for dragging dirt in and stuff. Right? I think that's supposed to symbolize or show you what the marriage is like.
Mm.
So at the Cadian Ball, it's the exact same characters before they're all married.
So like, okay,
5 years before. An Acadian ball, I guess, in that part of the southern parlance, is like the ball where men and women come together and agree to become engaged.
Yeah.
It starts with the husband. His name is Babanu, I think.
Yeah.
With an ex, Louisiana style.
Yeah.
The son doesn't exist yet. It starts with Babanu, and he's in love with Calixta.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not really reciprocating it. You know, she doesn't hate him, but he likes her.
Yeah.
And then they switch to the Alcee character.
Okay.
And he's in love with the lady who's his current wife. I forget her name. It's Clarissa or something similar to Calixta.
Clarice.
Yeah. And Alcee is like a planter who's handsome, and he starts off rich. He planted like 900 acres of rice. He loses it all in a storm. He pours his heart out to Clarissa.
Okay.
Clarice, whatever. Yeah. She rejects him. And he heads off on his own to the Cadian Ball. Clarice sees him riding off. And maybe, I think you're supposed to maybe, is it like, oh, he's, and she knows he's going to the ball, and she's kind of in a maybe jealousy or wanting what you can't have. She already turned him down.
Okay.
She sees him leaving, and she's like, oh, I want him now. I'm jealous now. Right. But he's riding off through the dark to the ball. He goes to the ball, and he's off on his own. Like, he winds up with Calixta. They're flirting. They were former lovers, even from before the Cadian Ball story.
So they kiss at the ball, right?
They had a fling before.
Okay.
And And so they're kind of just flirting in the old fashioned way. They're off on their own, whispering to each other and whatnot. So you get the sense there, Calixta really likes Alcy. Doesn't really, Bobbino is like a secondary in her mind. She's not into him as much. Clarice comes, like rides through the night chasing Alcy, tells Alcy she has something important to tell him. And he like gets up and leaves. And that's how they wind up together. Clarice changes her mind because she's jealous of him going to the ball. She leaves with him, and then Calixta at the end tells Bobbino, yeah, I guess I'll marry you, basically. So so that's the backstory. She basically settles for Bobbino after Alcy kind of leaves with Clarice, right? So that's generally what happens with at the Cadian ball. So there's that whole backstory. And I started with that. And so the storm actually kind of made perfect sense. Like, oh, okay. So it's 5 or so years later. Bobbino and Calixta have a kid, but she settled for him anyway. And then her old lover shows up at her doorstep, you know, to come in from the rain for the storm. Something happens, and then they go back, and it all kind of makes sense.
I was never like confused. I enjoyed the sort of intrigue of thinking about these characters, because I think there's enough like meat on the bone, so to speak, to give you some plausible things of,
you get the gist. But knowing the backstory, it kind of makes it is like a little sequel. You know, that's what happened to these people.
I like the there's a sentence near the end. Bomino's explanations and apologies, which he had been composing all along the way, died on his lips as Calixta felt him to see if he were dry, and seemed to express nothing but satisfaction at their safe return. It's like a very, there's a lot to unpack there. Like, he feels like he has, like, the past 5 years, he's been conditioned, or he told himself, I need to, maybe if, like, through fault of his own, like, he's kind of maybe not reliable is kind of what I'm, maybe.
I think he's reliable. He's not a incompetent or bubbling person. Okay. I think he just realized he married up, right? He married a prettier girl than maybe he deserves. And so he's kind of always looking to please her and worried about how she thinks of him, because she's just a bit out of his league.
And then also it seemed like the son, Bibi, and the first part laid his little hand on his father's knee and was not afraid. He's almost like helping his father through this like storm or ordeal. That's interesting. There's all these little things to unpack, which I appreciate in a short story, because it's, you can kind of get lost in an enjoyable way about like, all right, what does this mean? Because this hints at something that we only have 5 pages here, but a short story really doesn't work if you're not hinting at something outside of the story, right? If you're just contained within these pages, it's 5 minutes out of your day and you don't really think about it again. But I was thinking about this. I'm like, there's stuff here that just for me, and this is my own like reading of it, because you can kind of read this book in many different, there's a lot of like allegories about the rain. Her name is kind of like a flower. Is something I read, and I was like, okay, that wouldn't pop into my head right away, but why do you think this book wasn't published during her life, or this story wasn't published during her lifetime?
I think because it was about adultery.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of.
And then she's not explicit, but you know they do have an affair, and so I think it's probably it.
That, and also the fact that she sort of hints at like this is like something natural. Like almost,
she doesn't judge the character. She just kind of describes it happening.
Probably like almost like this is like a human like condition or right.
And she may or may not feel that way, but I did appreciate she just told it. You know, it just kind of described something that happened and reserved judgment. I think a lot of modern literary stuff is too preachy and judgy. It just described something that happened. You don't even have to agree with it, but it happened. Here you go. And like you say, it was really compact. Good short stories tend to be really compact, no extra fluff, no fat, just, you know, lean. And
I was really impressed with the story. Really impressed.
And usually I don't like the literary type short stories that are just serious where nothing much happens. But I actually find this type of stuff I do like, you know, because not much happens. But then there's a lot to unpack and something significant does happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a good literary short fiction. I'm glad we read it.
I'm taking you. I'm surprised I didn't read this in college. I'm be honest.
It does seem like the.
Yeah.
The
type. Do you want to go?
The other one you read about real quick?
The Regret. It's a story about a woman who is kind of never really been in love, or she was in love when she's 20. She's now 50. She doesn't have any kids. She lives alone. And a neighbor comes over and it says she has to drop off like 4 of her kids. Okay. And it's kind of like, she doesn't know how to deal with that. And doesn't, you know, just seems like like an intrusion into her world. Anyway, after like a couple of days, she learns to like love the kids, and like the little things that they do like make up her day, and she gets used to their schedules and their things. And then the neighbor comes back and takes away the kids, and she's like devastated. Obviously, Kate Chopin does this in a much more like eloquent way of like threading all these things through the story. I was impressed by that. I think Storm's probably a little bit better, but Regret was also very good. So,
okay.
So Kate Chopin. Sometimes it's like you hear the name, and you're like, okay, that's just going to be stuffy, boring, you know, this book, 19th century. But no, not the case with this. So
that's kind of what I assumed, but I agreed to it because they were going to be short. So, but no, I was wrong.
There you go. P.G. Woodhouse. Not surprising. Very funny. A little bit surprising. It's a bit of a ghost story.
Sort of. Yeah.
Kind of.
It's funny, right? It's good.
You want to do it? Yeah. Of course it's funny.
It was maybe the funniest thing he ever wrote. Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
The philosopher said it was probably the funniest thing he ever read.
Really?
Memoirs? Yeah.
You want to do a brief synopsis of the plot and what's going on?
Yeah. It is about a writer of gritty mystery novels who inherits his aunt's cottage out in the countryside. His aunt was a romance writer, very popular, very wealthy writer of romance. The mystery writer thinks it's just bilge, you know, rubbish, silly stuff. But he gets 5,000 pounds in the cottage, but he has to stay in the cottage to get the 5,000 pounds. Pounds are British money.
There you go.
And he finds the house is haunted, not by a ghost, but by the spirit of romance. And so the type of, what would you call it? The type of writing, the type of romantic love stories that his aunt wrote about work their way into his gritty mystery novels. And an actual girl from one of his aunt's novels shows up, and he finds himself falling in love with her, even though he doesn't want to. He wants to remain a bachelor. You notice in a lot of Woodhouse stories, the worst thing in the world that can happen to his protagonist is that he has to get married.
Is true. That is the worst thing. Well, that and writing romance.
Yeah. Well, and you'll find in the Jeeves and Wooster stories, a big part of like what can go wrong in Bertie Wooster's life is he's going to have to get married to some girl and he does not want to. But anyway, it's structured like a haunted house story. And the thing is, it's this mystery writer who doesn't want to get married. And it's I thought it was brilliantly structured. And of course with Woodhouse, it's his prose that makes it.
I don't know for sure, but it felt like a lot of like comedy movies take from this story in some way. Maybe not like the idea of like his aunt's writing just like appearing in his life without him like having any sort of like, that's a trope sort of in like, I feel like movies that are trying to be where some spirit like takes over someone's life for comedic effect, right?
Oh, sure. Like,
does that make sense? Where like they're trying not to do something, but something compels them to act in a way that they would otherwise not want to do. That's the funny thing. That's the humor in it.
Yeah.
Right. Trying to think of something where that you can almost say like Liar Liar, the movie, which like,
okay, yeah, I see what you mean.
You know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah.
That's not an exact analogy, but it's a little bit close where like,
I see what you mean. I think the brilliance of this is just a twist on what if instead of a scary ghost story, it's a silly, you know, it's a silly romance impedes the, you know, Woodhouse does that. Like the stakes for his characters are very silly, but his characters take them very seriously. And he plots it out very well. Like every turn of the plot makes sense story-wise. They're actually really well structured. They're just very funny.
And the thing that saves him is the dog, William.
Yeah, the dog's like a hero because he's about to propose to the girl at the end despite himself. He doesn't want to, but he's about to. And yeah, the dog.
I like that the friend of her father's who she was supposed to marry, and he shows up, and that's like, you're like, okay, almost like he's thinking, all right,
I'm going to get out of this, but
I'm going to get out. And the guy hears the story and he's like, you know what? I can't do this.
He rescued the dog from drowning in the river. And yeah. That spirit of the house seeps in. It is his hard nose. James Rodman's the guy's name. Mm-hmm. His hard nose editor who brooks no nonsense succumbs to the lure of the house. You know, everybody is like, you know, haunted house story. Except
they mentioned Turn of the Screw.
Like he was kind of playing with Turn of the Screw a little bit, which I can appreciate.
I appreciate this more than Turn of the Screw. I will say this is
way better than Turn of the Screw. what else? It's probably the best opening for a story, or my favorite opening for a story, maybe ever. Definitely top five. When the guy's asking Mr. Moliner, do you believe in ghosts? And then he's like, well, I don't like them, if that's what you mean. I was headbutted by one as a child. They're not goats. Ghosts. Oh. Yeah.
No, Woodhouse, it's funny. Like, he can be funny in a novel, but like the short story thing, that's, I would almost think that's more difficult to do.
He's got a ton of short stories, lots of little, the Moliner was the guy telling the story at the beginning. He says, my nephew, he's a character who pops up in Woodhouse's short stories. The guy kind of telling his stories at the bar, and he'll go into different, this happened to, it always, something always happens to somebody he knows, and he goes off into that's the Mr. Moliner stories.
Okay.
He's got another, the Eucridge stories about like a Scottish guy who's really cheap.
Gotcha.
Anyway, he's got, his short stories are pretty good too.
No, I really enjoyed it. It was.
So this is your second Woodhouse?
Yeah, we had Summer Lightning and now. And what, I only need to read about 200 more short stories or novels to kind of complete the.
I think you'll find it's not a chore.
No, I was looking for this short story, and on my Kindle, I thought I was downloading short stories, or I bought like for $1. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought while I was buying his short stories, it was actually all of his novels, or like 20 novels.
Hey, nice.
1,000 pages.
You gotta be, a lot of those will be fun to read. Is it with him? He didn't come up with his signature style. It took him a little bit to work up to that. So some of the early stuff, it's not bad, but it's not.
Doesn't have the wit to
consistently
it.
Consistently funny. It took him like, I think 10, 15 years to finally stumble on it. And when he did, he had like 50 years of writing because he lived in his 90s. So there's a ton of it, but his early, early stuff is a little different. I read a biography of him and it was fascinating. Also kind of depressing how many opportunities there were for writers back then. There were so many magazines who would pay you decent money just to write a story. It shows up in Honeysuckle Cottage, actually.
Hmm.
Like the aunt and the nephew were both prolific writers.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote three novels in 20 short stories a year. Like back then you really could, if you were halfway decent, you could make a living as a writer. That doesn't really happen nowadays. Side note.
Depressing note. No, really liked it. Really funny, kind of, you know, quick on its feet.
Yeah. Is one of his better, it might be his most well-known short story.
Okay.
Yeah, it works. You could read it on Valentine's Day or Halloween. You want to read it ritualistically.
Yeah, I see that.
Either way, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to transition over to our last short story, The Lottery?
Yeah. And this is one, if you ignored our spoiler warnings earlier, if you haven't read it, you really need to go into it not knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
So stop here and just read The Lottery. It takes 20
like
minutes.
It's like 10 pages.
We will spoil it, but seriously, this is one you don't want spoiled. So
let me start with The Lottery. I have the first paragraph here. This is what the story is about, and the first paragraph are completely, it makes the story better, but it's like a very interesting opening to this. It starts with, the morning on June 27th was clear and sunny with the fresh warmth of a full summer day. The flowers were blossoming profusely and the grass was richly green. The people of the village began to gather in the square between the post office and the bank around 10 o'clock. In some towns, there were as many people that the lottery took 2 days and had to be started on June 26th. But in this village, where there were only about 300 people, the whole lottery took place in less than 2 hours. So it could begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and still be through in time to allow the villagers to get home for noon dinner. So it seems very idyllic 1950s America, white picket fence. Children are assembling stones. Because I'll be honest, I went into the story knowing nothing. Okay.
Okay, good. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, huh, okay. And then they have a lottery. Now, I think it's brilliant that the story is called a lottery because in some ways a lottery can be good in most ways, and then it can also be bad, right?
Well, you don't know. Yeah.
You could write a paper like how lottery, like since the invention of like the military, like the draft lottery, like that makes it bad.
It could be a bad thing. But this is written in 1948, so it's pre-Vietnam.
But didn't there they have
drafts before? They had drafts for the World War One and Two. But it's also, hey, maybe you want to win a lottery, like a raffle.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, and you know, it is idyllic. It's modern. It's contemporary America. And you could think, okay, is this going to be like a Norman Rockwell type pleasant little story? It's Shirley Jackson, so maybe you suspect not. But still, you don't really know where it's going. And it just gradually builds into
So basically, yeah. So as we go along, the children are there first for this lottery, which is a community thing. It's a time-honored tradition, right? Next, the men show up, and then the women. I think that was, like, interesting, like, how the stages of people get there. Each household is there, some representative, and they draw sort of like a slip of paper out of this box. It's not the original box. The original box, it's some sort of maybe parts are from the original box.
Yeah, this is like a long-held tradition. They've done it for time out of mind.
I have some theories I want to get to you once I get done. So this one family, they draw this thing and it has like a little dot on it, and that means their family now has to. And at this point, I still don't know exactly what the reward or the whatever
their family have to choose someone in their family. They've been, that's been narrowed down, the lottery has to their family.
You know something is up because the wife of the guy who pulled it says it's like unfair and starts to protest like what's going on. So that's your first inkling that this is not gonna
turn. Might not want to win.
You might not want to win it. And is the Hutchinson, right? Is the family
Hutchinson's,
Mr. Hutchinson tells his wife to kind of be quiet because it's a very peculiar thing. Like her objection was he didn't have enough time to pick the, just like kind of crazy. Objection, like, how could you tell like which one?
An objection no one's going to buy. It's meant to be out of desperation, right?
Yeah. And then family now goes with the three kids. And the wife is interesting too, because she kind of tries to draw in, I believe it would be her daughter that is married to someone else. Is that correct? But
so.
She would draw with his family and not, okay. And they draw again, and this time it's the wife that picks the card, and you quickly realize, okay, that's not good. She starts to protest more, and then they start picking up stones. One older lady picks up a stone that she can only carry with two hands. Okay, so it's very heavy. Essentially gets stoned to death.
You figure out, so what happens is, if you're chosen the lottery, yeah, the rest of the town stones you to death, basically. And then it's just, it's built perfectly. It, you're fed the information.
An amazing story. It's truly an amazing story.
It is very good. And you don't realize the extent of what's going on until the very end. And you're like, oh, they, yeah.
I was reading
this person to death.
Yeah. This story took, like, brought on kind of a bit of a, like, people were angry with Shirley Jackson. They, I think it was the New Yorker that published this. I could be
published in the New Yorker in 1948.
And they sent her, when they got mail, they just forwarded it to her, which I thought was interesting. I was like, that's not nice. Some people would ask, like, what it's about. Some people would ask, like, is this actually a thing that's happening?
True. Yeah. Was this journalism? Yeah.
But it's just, there's some characters in here that are, there's like an old guy. I want to get to this old guy. Like, he's the old timey guy, right? This is his 77th lottery, mm-hmm, which I think is, like, at first I read the story the first time through, I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I read it through again, I was like, wait a second. Because the story also tells you that they used to do this lottery thing on, like, wood chips. That was when there was only a couple of people in the town, and now there's more. There's 300 people in the town, so that these paper. Yeah. So this guy would have started when it was, like, a pretty high chance of getting selected.
Yeah, he survived.
And he is the one who, like, fiercely defends this sort of tradition, this, like, crazy, because at one point in the story they start telling, like, oh, this town up there, they don't even do this tradition anymore. And this, yeah, guy's like, oh, that's terrible.
And the older, the more traditional members of the community are like, no, we need to do it for the,
and I was thinking, crops, right? He's so staunchly supportive of this, because he's never got, I mean, that he feels like some divine right that he will never get selected. You could probably come up with a theory a million different ways for why this guy's, but it's just an interesting character that I didn't really put much thought into the first time I read it, but the second time, I focused on this guy. I was like, why is he, like, there's a purpose there that I couldn't quite pin down.
I think it's especially older people who've been through something, they don't want to change it to make it easier, because he made it through, so why change it for,
gotcha,
for everybody else, right?
It's I love the story.
It's so really good. It's really good. I think it's probably her most famous. I think justifiably so. You know what I think set people off? Backlash to the New Yorker? The modern setting. Because it's a creepy story if you set it in a different world, like a fantasy world, or in the 1600s or something, in Europe in the Middle Ages, I think people buy it more. But you put it in modern America, it seems, I think it creeps people out, creeps me out how plausible it seems. Like, we don't literally do this anymore, but we kind of do, just not with stone. The modern setting and how plausible it was, I think, and the way it builds, I think it makes people uncomfortable.
I feel like you could do a deep dive on, like, tying this to, like, the question of why people don't stop, like, atrocities. You know, like, you're coming off the World War II, and there's been books and theory, and people have studied, like, why didn't it, towns were the concentration, like, why didn't they rise up and stop? I'm not saying that this is what this story is talking about, but
not specifically, but it's about that human social pressures and tradition go a long way. And it's bad stuff happens all the time, right? Unjust things happen all the time. And it's kind of social pressure, tradition. It's just, why people are the way they are. I think it kind of explodes the myth of progress. In modern society, we have this kind of myth that keeps us going, that bad things happened in the past. People were silly and superstitious in the past. We don't do that anymore. And this kind of like makes it uncomfortable. I think people still love this story if it's set in medieval Europe, but it's not as creepy because there is something plausible about it today. I think there are people today who would gleefully participate in this. I think there are people who would be hesitant, but still participate and be kind of relieved it's not them. Be like, I don't like it, but what am I going to do? I think it would, modern people, it would, in a town like this, it would play out kind of like it plays out in the story. You know what I mean? I really do think there's something deeply disturbing about human nature that she's kind of exposing. And that's what makes it so creepy. I think that explains the backlash to it when it's first published. I think there's something deeply, deeply true about people and society. And that's just summed up in this little, 10-page story?
And there are moments where you're just like, oh my gosh, this is just like the, so you kind of figure out, okay, there's so much to unpack in the story. Like, we're not going to do it justice, but like, at this point, Mr. Sumner's kind of the guy who's running the lottery, and he goes, all right, folks, let's finish quickly. And then he goes, although the villagers had forgotten the ritual and lost the original black box, they still remember to use stones. And the pile of stones the boys had made earlier was ready. That's so good.
Yeah, and you see the kids piling stones. It's a good, because you think, maybe they're just playing because they're bored. But then at the end, the callback is everybody used, like the kids are participating in the piling of the stones for later. And then at the end, when you realize what they're doing, you realize that's what's happened. Like the purpose of the stone, it's a nicely plotted callback to the beginning.
And then
she's a good writer. She's a very good creepy writer.
This is high level stuff. This is good as it gets, really. With just it's subversive. It's unsettling. It's just really, really good.
But are you doing a little time capsule or an edition, an anthology, best American stories? Gotta be one of the first few on the list, right?
I had a thought here, and I think you would like, as far as you have this story of the lottery, I think it would be interesting, or like, this really isn't Flashman-ing, but what if someone wrote a story about like the beginnings of the lottery, or like tell a story where the ending is the creation of June 27th as the day of the lottery. Like, what would have to transpire for this to be like, you know what we should do every year in the summer? So we should stone someone from the town. And there's, because the book hints at a long history of like, in that quote I said, there's a ritual, there used to be like a saying that they would do, all this kind of stuff. They kind of lose all the fat, so to speak, of the ritual or the lottery, and they just keep the names and the stoning.
Yeah.
And it's just like everything else, the past is sort of hinted at, and you can kind of come up with what it would look like beforehand. But man, it's just a good story.
I see what you mean. A prequel might be interesting, but I don't know. I think it kind of maybe works more if it's just kind of there.
No, I don't. But like,
you know,
it's just an interesting concept that if done right, it's, you go in knowing that the story will end in someone like this lottery happening. I think that actually builds tension in the story, because you're like, all right, how is this going to happen? Like, how are we going to get from this small community to, we have a day where we stone someone to death. And that, I think knowing what happens can build tension, I guess. Because there's a, not to get too sidetracked, there's a movie called White Ribbon. Okay. It's a German movie, came out 10, 15 years ago. And they shot it in black and white. And it takes place in like the 20s in Germany, in this village where all this strange stuff happens, where people are getting injured. And it turns out that the kids are the culprits to all this bad stuff. Like, people are dying from like weird, like, it almost seemed, people think it's, I think it's like a ghost, but it actually it's the kids playing pranks on people and getting them hurt. And the sort of the point behind the movie at the very end is these same kids are actually going to be these sort of people that enact sort of the German policy in 20, 30 years. Like, these are,
oh, it's like pre-World War II.
Yeah, pre-World War II. These are going to be like the sort of quote-unquote Nazis who commit horrific acts, and they kind of do these sort of like very morose and kind of like, oh, geez, these kids are like out of control, like killing people on accident. And that was kind of the, that was in my head when I was thinking about this. Like, what is the setting to create the lottery? I don't know. That's, I love this story.
Well, you know, I'd be shocked if Suzanne Collins, who wrote The Hunger Games, wasn't inspired by this. That's, have you read those or seen the movies?
I did think about that.
The initial selection process. I would be shocked if it didn't spring from it,
like, I haven't read those books. I've seen one of the movies, but yeah, you're right. It's
just the springboard and like a little homage or something.
Oh yeah. It's not like, you know,
Yeah.
I definitely think that. So any other thoughts on any of the short stories, Matt? Any,
which one do you think is the most filmable / which one would you like to see a movie made out of? Or any of them filmable?
I still like my idea with the lottery as far as a prequel type thing. I would guess the lottery, because there's, I feel like there's an, you can expand on it maybe in a way.
So they made there's a 1996 version.
Okay.
I didn't watch. It's a full length movie, so I wonder how they, I don't know, from the poster, I gather maybe it's like a couple moves to a small town and there's a strange ritual, and it's not just Robin, our patron, actually sent me, there was a 1969 version. It's like 20 minutes. It's on YouTube. That was actually kind of true to this. I watched that. That's true to the story. And it's just pretty, I mean, it's a, you know, 1969 little film, but yeah. You know what? There was a version of Honeysuckle Cottage that was supposed to happen with Val Kilmer, and Christopher Guest was going to direct, and it fell through.
Huh.
That is a shame. I think that would have been fun.
Because you, that Honeysuckle Cottage, actually, that whole, like, the middle part of it, where you could expand on that, like, quite a bit.
Yeah, and I don't, Woodhouse, I think, is hard to film. It's been done.
Yeah, but I can see how
I think that Christopher Guest would have been the one to do it. I mean, Val Kilmer could have done it, played the mystery writer. The right director could make a pretty funny movie of that. It's really too bad that that fell through. That would have been fun.
Yeah.
You know who Christopher Guest is, right?
Yeah.
Best in Show. And yeah.
His sensibilities of like comedy, I think, would work well with Woodhouse, but it, like you said, it works so well on the page that sometimes it's,
I don't know who, I don't trust anybody modern to do it. I guess Christopher Guest still, Val Kilmer couldn't do it now, but Guest could still direct, but yeah.
Is Val Kilmer dead?
No, he had throat cancer though.
Oh.
It's actually, he had a little documentary about him and what he's doing now that he produced. It's actually pretty good.
Oh, interesting.
Forget how much stuff he was in. Like, yeah, he was solid. He was a
very, very good name, Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer, actually, really good name.
Solid name.
Side note, it's worth a watch. The little Val, it's on Amazon, the Val Kilmer documentary.
We have some movie recommends at the end of this episode. I like this. No, I think we should do this again next year. A little spring short stories.
Or we need a break. We could do it again in July.
It's true.
We need to catch up. It's fun. It's not a, you know, it's not a cop out. We read three very literary.
I think these are some of the best things we're probably going to read all year. And that's not like.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, let me put it this way. We will read something worse than what we read.
Oh, no, these were good. These were great.
Yeah.
We're reading, we got a good year. I started Burr.
There you go.
I love that book. It's been like 15 years since I read it. I'm dipping back in. It's great. I'm really enjoying our books. Started the Manticore.
There we go.
Good stuff.
So let me do a quick rundown of our TBR. As Matt mentioned, we have our latest book that we added to our TBR is Burr by Gore Vidal. This one has been... We're finally doing Gore Vidal on the podcast. I've never read Gore Vidal. Gore Vidal is one of Matt's favorites, so that'll be fun once we...
You read the essay.
Read the essay, that's true. Yeah, you know what I mean? You know, come on. I'm not going to be like going to parties being like, oh yeah, I know Gore Vidal, like the back of my hand. We continue on with the Manticore, the second book in the Robson Davies series. We have A Time to Be Born, Don Powell. I finished this book. I texted Matt kind of while I was reading this. Don Powell's a genius. More people need to read Don Powell. She has a paragraph, maybe two paragraphs, in this little section near the end of this book. It is some of the best writing that I have read in a long time. And it's just like Wicked Pavilion, where I'm like, I feel like she knows that she can do this. She just doesn't do it all. It's like this. Hemingway wishes he could write like a paragraph like this. So when we get to that, I want to read that paragraph because it's just, it blew me away. I was like, you put this in like with 20 pages left of the book? I'm like, oh my God.
I'm not there yet. I'm going to see if I can.
I'll
keep an eye on it and see if I can guess which one.
The whole book is fantastic. She is just
nails people. I love it. Just she's so sharp.
Oh,
nails people and their motives and plots it well. It's great.
She's the surgeon. That's what I'm gonna call her. She's the surgeon. She's just
very, very, very sharp.
Like, oh, perfect. Criminally underrated, Don Powell.
It really is bad. Like she's one of the five best writers America's produced.
Penguin Classic needs to put her books out in like a Penguin Classic.
With better covers, my cover, I'll post on Instagram. I've never seen a greater disparity between the quality of a book and my cover of A Time to Be Born. Just the graphic production value. The disparity is as big as I've ever seen.
But no, really, like Penguin Classic, you know, the black covers or whatever, they need to do these books.
So they have to, I have the American.
That's the library, yeah, Library of
I have that one.
America. They have like the two, I think they have two, right? Other, that's good. You should be able to get like a $15 paperback of Wicked Pavilion.
They need to we're doing our part to bring her back, get her reprinted with some actual, you know, people didn't know how to market her. We'll get into it. I'll save some for the episode. But her publishers at the time, and I think since, just have no idea how to market the title.
Yeah, we should come up with like a pitch because it's
sad. Yeah, they have.
I was thinking, I was like, would everyone like this as much as we do? I'm like, yeah, maybe not
everybody, but enough people would.
Yeah,
I think.
Just that's not you. You were very correct when you're like, I think you'll like this. And I was like, okay, you know, sometimes the recommends are, but man, so good. So, so good. We also have The Master Margarita. We have Jay Bear Crow. Matt's dad has put that on our TBR. I also wrote down Memories of Old Jack, but I don't, Matt's going to cancel that one out. But
well, let's do Jay Bear Crow first. Let's get ahead of ourselves.
The Once and Future King. Life and Fate, that is, I'm currently making progress on that. As an aside, there's a part in that book, it's one of the saddest, it's not it's not a scene per se, it's a letter that's written by one of the characters, and it is, I'm not usually one to get very emotional while reading, but I kind of got a little, I'm like, oh my gosh,
choked up.
It's one of the saddest things. Anyway,
I look forward to that.
That is, no, the book is incredible. I don't really know how he, I think there's maybe 100 plus, you know, 150 maybe characters in this book, and he's, and they're all kind of, you don't get too overwhelmed, at least I haven't so far, and it's pretty incredible that this is like the talent and time and effort that it took to write this book is pretty impressive. So far I'm very impressed by Life and Fate. So am I missing anything, Matt?
David Foster Wallace essays.
David Foster Wallace essays, okay.
Which doesn't be easy. Just we'll do one essay here halfway soon.
Yeah.
We're gonna pick a new thriller over on our Patreon thriller corner.
We just finished Slow Horses. So that episode's over on our Patreon. That is a fantastic book, and it, I don't know about the rest of the books in the series. I imagine they are just as good. So if you're curious about our Patreon, you can sign up for not that much money and support us over there. And we put out content. I put out my March library recap over there. Finished the library book from March. I wrote about the books I added to my TBR and the ones I didn't get to. It's a little fun side project I have over there. So I think we're going to pick a baseball book or two coming up. So
a baseball book, a new thriller. We do all sorts of fun stuff like that over there. It's a good way. Starts at $3. You get a mug, some bookmarks, and lots of bonus content.
Yeah, there you go.
Great to check it out.
So a lot of good stuff coming up as we head into summer. So as always, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon.